Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After 15 years as Chancellor of the University of North Carolina Charlotte, Phil Dubois will retire at the end of June. During his time, UNC Charlotte has experienced tremendous growth. The student population has surged, and to accommodate that, the college went on a building spree and also opened an uptown campus. The two campuses are tied together by light rail, which also played a role in another of Phil Dubois' goals, further integrating the school into the fabric of Charlotte. Under his leadership, new degree programs have been established, research programs expanded, and Division I football arrived, and those are just some of the high spots. Like other schools, they've completely altered their teaching model during this COVID-19 world, and that is also why we have asked the Chancellor to join us for his exit interview via Zoom. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good to see you again, even if it is only on a little screen here. Good morning. You've been at UNC Charlotte as Chancellor for 15 years, and it doesn't seem like all that long a time, but a lot has changed, both in Charlotte and on your campus. So compare the school today with what it was like when you took over the reins as the fourth Chancellor there.
Well, Mike, it's changed in a number of ways. The things that people most notice have to do with the physical infrastructure. As you mentioned in your introduction, the growth in the enrollment, which has been over 40%, required us to respond with academic buildings, student facilities, building a student union, expanding residence halls. Contrary to public opinion, I did build parking decks to accommodate all that growth, and the light rail. And so I think people would most notice the physical infrastructure, and that's good. I feel good about that because those buildings will be here forever. And whoever comes after me basically has a pretty well-established physical infrastructure and can focus their attention on maintaining it, but also building programs.
I was reading yesterday, one of the things that I read is that the one thing you've been unsuccessful at is stopping people from calling the school UNCC. You like UNC Charlotte, and I will tell you that your PR people and the people who help us get guests who are professors, etc., at UNC Charlotte, whenever I say UNCC, they step in immediately and correct me. Tell me, what's the difference? Why do you like UNC Charlotte?
We have tried so hard, but when it's on your webpage and it's in your email address, the only thing I could do was joke that it meant under construction constantly. It's been difficult. But what we wanted to do was to build upon the equity of the University of North Carolina system, its reputation for quality. And we didn't want to be seen as the original commuter college that we were. We of course, a great deal of respect for Central Piedmont Community College, which of course goes by CPCC. So we were just trying to draw a distinction, and it didn't begin with me. It began with Jim Woodward, and he tried for 16 years and I've tried for 15 years. And so I think that ball game's pretty well over, but we'll see what Sharon Gaber has to say when she takes office as my successor.
So you actually arrived there in 1991 as the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. You were recruited to come there, and then you left to go to the University of Wyoming in 1997, only to return in 2005 as Chancellor. What lured you back?
Well, it meant a lot to me personally to be able to succeed my mentor, Jim Woodward. And I just felt this was going to be the best job in higher education with the way it looked Charlotte would be growing and the university had plenty of room for growth. So it was that. And in Wyoming, it was just time to go from Wyoming. I loved it there. My wife and I raised our family there. It was a tremendous place. And I was the lead official for higher education, probably second only to the governor in terms of visibility and a leadership role in that state. But 8 years was a long time. I'd done what I wanted to do. The opportunity to come back to Charlotte meant a lot to me, and our kids were up and out. Only our daughter was at home at that point in high school, so it was a great opportunity to come back and succeed Jim. I mused around with the idea of trying to beat his record of 16 years, but then I concluded no one would know or care. So when my wife and I started to discuss retirement about 18 months ago or so, this seemed like the right time.
Yeah. In 1991, when you first arrived there physically, the campus was incredibly different.
Oh, my.
from what it is today. And I would imagine different academically, and also different in terms of how the school interfaced with the city and what its importance to the, and its function in the city of Charlotte was. Would that be accurate?
I think that is accurate. You know, Jim Woodward spent all of his time, a good bit of his time, positioning us for what has happened under my administration. He got us the status as a doctoral granting institution, and I was his provost, and we began the first doctoral programs. I worked very hard with Jim to get authority to have a downtown presence even then. And we did take our MBA program downtown, but I don't think anybody knew it. It was in the crafts. Originally, it was in the old city fair, if you remember that. Mm. And then it got moved over to the upper floors of the Mint Museum Center for Craft and Design. And so it wasn't until we built the Center City building and got it open in 2011 that we really began to have that kind of visible presence in Center City. By the time I returned in 2005, after having been gone for 8 years, the number of doctoral programs had grown from 4 to 14,
right,
and I've grown that to 24. And we've taken the number of master's programs up. I think we've added something like 17 master's programs since I've been here. And then at the undergraduate level, adding important, I've called them signature initiatives in both energy and data science.
In the 90s, when you were there as provost and also vice chancellor for academic affairs, what were those first graduate degree programs that you established, and why? Why those disciplines of study?
It was a hard-fought political fight because our colleagues up at North Carolina Chapel Hill and NC State weren't sure that a new doctoral institution was a good idea. So we carefully looked at programs that seemed to have relevance to the economic future of Charlotte. And we focused mostly in engineering, education, and a couple of applied areas relevant to the financial services industry. So that's where we started, and we've grown it out since then. But we still don't have doctoral programs broadly in the humanities, which I think eventually this place will have. We have very focused doctoral programs in areas like public policy and things relating to the urban environment. So we've come a long way, a lot of room to go. This institution, as I've said since the Amazon discussion, probably needs to be 40,000, 45,000 strong. Mm. It's going to have the kind of educational horsepower at the post-secondary level that we need to continue economic development.
When you talk about the politics and the struggle to get to the Board of Governors, I guess they were the body that said, yes, you can start these degree programs. When you talk about that, is there reluctance to start those programs based on economics, being able to bring professors in those disciplines of the caliber that you need to have a degree program and then to enroll students in those programs? Or is it more, we don't want to compete necessarily with UNC Chapel Hill?
I don't think it's the latter at this point. Because Charlotte is such a dynamic region, because we've been the fastest growing institution in the system, and because I think members of the Board of Governors appreciate the linkage between higher education and economic development, we've not had a single program turned down that we've put forward. They're mostly concerned about duplication within the system. And they're also very, very concerned about the fact that you could demonstrate need and enrollment in those programs. And we've been able to do that every time. So now I think active Board of Governors has been very good to UNC Charlotte. And we have a little bit of an advantage because of our geographic isolation. When people undertake graduate study in particular, they're not going to do a lot of it if they have to drive a long distance. And although you can do some things online, of course.
I want to reiterate, since you've become chancellor, you oversaw the start of new academic degree programs. 10 bachelor's degrees were created under your tenure, 17 master's degrees, 12 doctoral degrees. I think I have those numbers right, among others. Put those numbers in perspective. That seems like a lot of new degree programs in 15 years. Is it? And what academic disciplines have these new areas of study been in?
Well, I don't think I can remember all of them, but at the same time, we've also taken offline some things that didn't have the enrollment anymore, and or we combined some disciplines. But as I said, I think at the undergraduate level, our most serious initiative has been the initiative in data science, and that one, we just started our bachelor's programs there, and we announced the first school of data science in the entire state of North Carolina. So I think that's a significant initiative. In the master's level, we've had some important health-related initiatives. And at the doctoral level, we, like I said, we've continued to expand there. We've got a full range of programs now in public health, accredited programs at the bachelor's, master's, and doctoral levels. And I would think that that's the next chancellor may very well want to push for the idea of a school of public health, not competing with the one at Chapel Hill, which is world renowned, but focused a lot on international public health and the kind of crisis we're going through now. But our School of Public Health could very much focus on urban public health, metropolitan and public health, and the elimination of health disparities among different populations, which this particular crisis has shown across the board.
Under these stay-at-home orders, you and all the other academic institutions in this state and around the country have shut their doors and gone online with their instruction. And I know that it was announced yesterday that the university system intends to open again with classrooms on the 7th of September, if that is at all possible. You also told me just before we started that you were busier than ever during this online period where the campus is actually closed to students and faculty. What's taking all of your time?
Well, the first one is figuring out when we could open. And judging from the talking with the folks at the county health department and the county manager, Dina DiOrio, we expect the surge in cases in Charlotte and Mecklenburg to be in mid-June. And if that turns out, we wanted to know, how do we buy a little space from the virus, knowing that it could recur in the fall or the winter. And so we decided to delay for 2 weeks, start September 7th. And what we're spending time on is trying to figure out how to envision socially distant in-class instruction and student activities. So for example, how many people can we let in our student union? If we have a classroom of 35 students in a small classroom, but they're sitting shoulder to shoulder, how do we spread them out? Do we require some of the sections to be meeting once a week in class, but once a week online? How do we just pull people apart? I'm trying to figure out, as you know, I do a lot of entertaining in the chancellor's official residence, Bissell House, and that's to greet faculty, staff, students, community leadership, political officials. I'm not sure I know what life is going to be like for a chancellor in a socially distant functioning methodology. So we got a lot of things to figure out. What are we going to do about athletics? And I just asked the question yesterday, will people be able to go to football games? And I think, well, if we're playing football, yeah, but maybe we can't have people sitting in every single seat. That didn't used to be a problem, Mike.
But it is now.
It is now.
Well, congratulations on that. I retract my original joke about UNC and football. From the Charlotte Squawks days. Phil Dubois is our guest. He's the chancellor, the outgoing chancellor of the University of North Carolina. We will continue in just a moment.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, Phil Dubois, who will be retiring on at the end of June. You made your, and this is kind of the exit interview. we do this. You made your announcement in July of last year, which gave the university a year to find your replacement. And you said at the time that your wife, you and your wife, had started talking about 8 to 10 months prior to July of 2019 about what retirement would look like. But there was some deck shuffling going on within the University of North Carolina system at the time, I believe. And you said last July, "I simply wanted to go out on my own terms, and that's what we're going to do." How much did the changing nature of the Board of Governors of the university system play in this decision, that now was the time?
Nothing at all to do with that. I'd been, as you mentioned, president at Wyoming for 8 years, and I'm finishing up now 15 years. That's 23 years as a college president. I think my research people tell me there are only 10 people in the country, maybe eight, who've served longer. And it just became time to do something different. I'm 69 years old. I'm in good health. I don't want to die at the desk. Lisa and I were looking around for a possible place to retire. Our son and his wife had twin boys prematurely about a year ago, but they spent 10 weeks in the NIC unit and they're doing great. And we just wanted the opportunity to make sure we could enjoy them as they grow up. So we'll be about an hour and a half east of Atlanta, where my son and his wife live. And we have two grown children who are still here in Charlotte. But no, it didn't have anything to do with politics. It had all to do with Phil wanting to enjoy additional time in his life with his wife of 44 years and go out in a way that made sense. I honestly, Mike, we're having this interview now because I was going to take a vacation starting May 15th until the end of June. Unfortunately, because of the virus, there's no place to take a vacation to. So I just offered to the trustees that I would stay on as Chancellor Remoteness until I can become Chancellor Emeritus on July 1.
Well, only reason I ask is because you had an interview last March, with March of 2019, with the Charlotte Business Journal, in which you said, "There's no mandatory retirement. As long as I have interest and energy and excitement about this job, I'm going to do it." And then July rolls around and you decide I'm done. So I was just curious about what happened, what changed.
Well, a couple things. I mean, obviously, April 30th had some impact. Yeah. As to the timing, we had actually bought our home in Georgia 2 weeks before the shootings. And it was really a matter of how long I was going to stay on, whether it was going to be several months or longer. But once the shootings occurred, I looked at her and she looked at me and we knew we had to be here. We'd been through this before with campus tragedies in Wyoming. I was president when Matthew Shepard was the victim of a hate crime, and I had 8 student athletes die in a car crash. So I knew that first anniversaries of major tragedies required leadership from the top, and there was no one else to do it. And so I felt the obligation to be here through last week and into the end of this year. But no, combination of things, no one thing did it. It was just ready to do something different at this point and try to get my golf game in the 80s.
Well, I was going to ask what your retirement's going to look like. What is it going to look like? Because you've been really busy, and all of a sudden this busyness is going to be a lot of time for you.
Well, it may be the time. My wife, Lisa, has said she doesn't know what I'll do if I'm not in charge of something. So she bought me a puppy. No, we're going to go down there. We're going to be in a lovely community. I'm going to try to do higher ed consulting. I'm not sure what that's going to look like with COVID still around, but I've already signed on with the American Council on Education to do some work with their, it's called the ACE Fellows Program, and I'll be a distinguished scholar with them next year. So I've got some things in the kettle that are starting to cook, but we're going to take it easy. It'll take us a while to get settled, and my wife and I have been on dozens of cruises, and I know it sounds crazy, but I think there's going to be some pretty good prices out there.
Yeah, if you want to take advantage of it. During your tenure, and we've kind of alluded to this, the student enrollment at UNC Charlotte grew 43%. That's a big number. It's unprecedented growth for that school and perhaps other schools around the state. Is that what happens when a university is located in a city that is also growing by leaps and bounds, or were there other factors involved in that growth?
Well, it was intentional, and it was in part a function of the growth of the community. But the attitude of UNC Charlotte as an institution has always been to provide opportunity for people. We could have chosen not to grow and just become much more selective in the students we would agree to take. But no, we decided that as a result of the vision of Bonnie Cohn and carried through all of our chancellors up to me, if a student is prepared for college level work and has an opportunity to be successful, and they're not always successful for a variety of reasons, but we wanted to provide that opportunity, and we had that tremendous growth. We did slow it during the recession. Because of the budget reductions and such, we didn't go as fast. But I can tell you today that the freshman class for the fall of 2020, this freshman class will be the largest in our history, and not a little. Our largest freshman class was about 3,800 in 2018. We'll probably be around 4,200 in our freshman class. So we've had tremendous growth, and it's going to continue. Our admissions people have been trying to stay in touch with our prospective students via Zoom, for example, and other methods over the last several weeks. And we're conducting our fall orientation program right now online. So we look forward to a good opening fall.
Going along with the explosion in the number of students, there was that explosion in construction. You spent $1.2 billion on buildings since 2005. Was that to accommodate the growing student body, or was that to encourage growth and to attract students to the university?
Actually, it's a little bit of everything, Mike. Funny enough, in the height of the recession, when we saw construction go down everywhere, we made a strategic decision to build parking decks that we knew we would eventually need, but we could get them on the cheap. So we built parking decks in anticipation of growth. We built some things in light of our growth and changes in our student body. So when we started to get away from being a commuter school and being more of a residential college, we knew we would need a great student union. We knew we would need a recreation center for those students and so on. So, and then of course we needed the academic buildings, and some of them were on campus and some of them, such as Center City, were designed to serve a different population of people. So different strategies for different things. And then some were the result of industry or business influence. So for example, the energy industry came to us in the mid-2000s and said, look, our energy engineers are retiring and we need good, solid engineers to build and maintain power plants, whether at that time they were talking nuclear, but it could be conventional fueled power plants or alternative energy. And so we went to the legislature. They supported us for $77 million for the energy production and infrastructure building. And then they gave us $5 million to hire faculty and staff. That's a very successful program now with Duke Energy and other energy-related industries in Charlotte that have formed this cluster of energy production in this region.
You talked about the transition from being a commuter school to being largely an on-campus residence kind of school. And there's been talk in this COVID-19 world in which we now live among academics about what this is going to look like going forward for universities, whether parents and or students will want to travel miles away from home to live in a dorm when they could go to a commuter college closer to home. What do you think the upshot of all this will be?
Well, if I have to judge from my statements of intent to register for fall of 2020, I'd say they want to go to their university. Now, a good number of our students, 90% of our students are from within North Carolina at the undergraduate level. So it's not as big a deal in terms of traveling across the country. And probably, if you count the region, a majority of our students are from the region. Although one of the changes over the last 15 years has been we're now drawing significantly from the triangle, and those percentages have gone up every year as well. But it's 2.5 hours. It's not 10 hours.
Right.
We're trying to figure out, as I said earlier, what is this going to look like? We think we've got the residence hall issue figured out as best we can. But these students who are 19 and 20, social distancing isn't in their normal way of thinking. And we're going to have to, we're working hard at the question of how do we keep them spread out a little bit as they come back to school. We talked about the fact that we may have masks in vending machines just to make sure people use them when they need them. And so, again, the virus is going to push a lot of these decisions forward without us knowing exactly how it's going to play out. But we're hoping we can have a fall and productive, safe and productive fall.
You talked a little while ago about how when you were here in the 90s, you pushed for and achieved having some academic programs moved downtown, first in the City Fair building, which is now the Hearst Tower, and then into the second floor of the Arts and Crafts annex to the Mint Museum. Now you have a building downtown. Why did you feel, particularly back in the 90s, when there was virtually no traffic? I mean, people who have not lived here long don't understand what's happened with traffic here, but you could really get to UNC Charlotte from Center City in about 13 minutes, 15 minutes at the time. Why did you feel it was necessary to bring instruction downtown when people could get there like that?
Well, I think this, Jim Woodward and I worked very closely together on this. And in fact, it was a groundbreaking, pardon the pun, initiative, because at that time, this is the early 90s, there was no off-campus center in the UNC system for which the credit hours delivered would be recognized for funding purposes. So we had to get them to agree to let us do two things: move instruction off the campus, and then secondly, recognize the students enrolled in those courses for funding. And we originally made a partnership with folks to get into City Fair, and then Graham Keith, as a matter of fact, and then that building, as I said, moved over to the Mint Museum later on. When I returned to interview in 2005, they took me downtown to lunch, and I went, "No, you're kidding me. We're not going downtown to lunch in Charlotte. Kidding? What the heck?" But the original initiative in 1990s was to reach out to that downtown business community. It was to really get people who were already working enrolled in higher education. And then when I got back in 2005, I really said, we need a much more visible presence here. Funny enough, Jim Woodward had acquired the property at 9th and Brevard in March of 2005. So when I got here in the summer, I just altered our legislative priority list, and Erskine Bowles pushed it through the General Assembly, and we got the building built.
And that building has just been renamed the Dubois Center at UNC Charlotte Center City as a tribute to you. For people who don't know, it's at 9th and Brevard, and it looks like a stack of books that has not been exactly lined up neatly. That's on purpose. But congratulations on the honor that they gave you and your wife, Linda, because they did that to highlight her contributions to the school as well. Talk about them. I'm not sure many people know about her contributions to the university.
Yeah, well, that's my second wife, Linda. My first wife is Lisa.
I'm sorry. It says Lisa right here.
Yeah. Partner in crime every step of the way. You know, being a chancellor involves a great amount of entertaining of people, welcoming them to campus. And she's run hundreds of events at the chancellor's residence. She basically founded our family and parent center on campus to support the families of new students and continuing students. She was a co-founder with Betty Chafin Rash of the Charlotte Women's Summit, which was based on the concept of conducting research on the condition of women and girls in Charlotte-Mecklenburg and converting that into public policy initiatives. And that summit eventually became part of the university in our Urban Institute. She was an active chair and member of communities in schools, and worked her heart out in that institution, rewrote their bylaws, helped hire their dynamic leader, Molly Shaw. And most recently, she's been doing a tour as a chair, just went off as being chair of the Charlotte Public Art Commission. So the new exhibit in the terminal out there, the digital exhibit, is part of her work out there. So I was very glad that we were both going to get our names on the building. They settled on Dubois Center because it's a mouthful to say Philip L. and Lisa Lewis Dubois. But we're very pleased by it.
And last year, I'm told, the school indicated a location had been identified for a second, or a second location downtown had been identified. Where would that be?
We've had ongoing conversations with the Levines about the property directly across the street from 9th, on 9th and Brevard, but no decision made and no funding identified. I think we would like eventually, if we had to do something, do it there.
You've often talked, I believe, about the importance of integrating the school into Charlotte and helping Charlotte make better use of what the institution has to offer. Is that downtown building part of that, and could it be done without that?
Oh, it could have been done without that, but I think that's been a major part of it. The other issue has been we developed some facilities and programs on campus that invited in the community. Historically, the Urban Institute has been the biggest asset of the community for getting research done that is relevant to problems in Charlotte, whether it's homelessness or whatever it might be. But we created the Portal Building, which is basically our business incubator, and we've got a couple of dozen businesses incubating in there, and that's a place to bring in people to talk about the state of the Charlotte economy. And then light rail has been important in two ways, getting people to campus and getting the campus to the city and giving our students an opportunity to take full advantage of all the amenities in Charlotte. Now, right now, of course, that's been limited by the virus. But prior to that, light rail was allowing our students to get down there in large numbers. My often repeated joke was you could see our students headed to their internships on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights. They were dressed in their finery to go to those internships. But I think the point is that if you're going to have the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, one of your biggest recruiting tools is the city. And light rail helped us get our students into the city.
Phil Dubois is the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He's retiring at the end of June. We'll talk about diversity. We'll talk about a little bit more about the impact of light rail on the campus and football and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Phil Dubois is with us. He's the Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, retiring in June. The exit interview proceeds, segment 3. And thank you for doing it, by the way. There are 16 schools in the University of North Carolina system, all with different attributes, I suppose, and different kinds of campuses. How do students decide? If a student is interested in the University of North Carolina system, what makes them choose you over one of the other schools in the system, do you think?
Well, I think they're...
Hold on just a second, Doctor. I think we've lost Dr. Dubois. There we go. Now, we lost you for a second at the very beginning of the answer. So start over again.
Yeah, and I lost you as well when you asked the question. So I hope I'm in the right question.
So the question was, what makes a student choose you over the other 15 in the system?
Yeah, I think all the schools are doing quite well right now in terms of recruitment. But our approach has always been to emphasize the quality undergraduate education with a full range of academic programs that many of which relate to the problems of a metropolitan region. At least at the undergraduate level, we think we've built out now many of the things that undergraduates are looking for. We've either built or renovated all of our residence halls to, I think, what are current students' expectations. And we have this incredible set of student groups and opportunities, about 400 student clubs, a a great student union. And I, frankly, I'd hold up the beauty of my campus to any in the country. So we don't necessarily have to pitch anything extraordinarily different. When students come to tour, though, they make up a decision about whether it feels right, and their parents get a sense about whether it's going to be a safe and nurturing place for their students. So probably a combination of things.
We hear a lot about diversity in education, particularly in the lower grades, and the importance of diversity. And a lot of these young people coming to college have been in situations at school where they have been in diversified classrooms. And yet that's been one of your pushes at the university. And you established the Diversity Challenge Fund early in your tenure there so that you could provide student opportunities to interact with individuals from different backgrounds, not like themselves. Why do those students need that, given the history of American education at the lower levels, and what does it give them as a college student?
I think the premise behind diversity in higher education has been that if you're going to go out in the world today and function effectively, whether you're going to be living and working in the United States or living and working around the world, you're going to need to understand different life experiences and different cultures. And that's been the premise behind our initiative, is to expose students to the world in which they will eventually work and function. In the case of UNC Charlotte, the campus diversity has been growing over time as well. We have a very, probably next to UNC Greensboro, in the UNC system, we would be considered the most diverse of the schools that used to be called, in the terminology of the UNC system, historically white, as opposed from the historic black colleges and universities in North Carolina. So about 40% of our students would be considered diverse, including our international students. People may not know, we have the second largest number of international students in the UNC system behind NC State. And we have a very significant population of African-American students. And I've made the point, about 17%, I made the point that we have wonderful historically black colleges and universities in North Carolina and in the country, but we educate as many African-American students and graduate as many African-American students as more than 90% of the HBCUs in the country. So we're a minority serving institution in ways that people may not appreciate. So in that larger context, Mike, our students need to understand all the different and benefit from the different perspectives that are brought into the classroom by a diverse student population, whether it's domestic or international. I had the Diversity Challenge Fund when I was in Wyoming. Now, that was a much greater challenge in Wyoming on the diversity front. But the goal here has been to bring to the campus programs, activities, speaker, music, art, things that our students may not otherwise get a chance to see. And a lot of our domestic North Carolina students, as was the case in Wyoming, had never left the state. So it was a chance to bring it to them and give them a taste of what life is going to be like in the years ahead. And you know, the country is going to become more diverse, not less.
UNC Charlotte, because of where it is in the city of Charlotte, seems to be out there someplace in a lot of people's minds. It really isn't that far, but Bonnie Cohn put it out there, and I'm sure there are reasons for it being there as opposed to downtown. But you've always been concerned about making sure that the school is connected to Charlotte in many different ways and vice versa. And here are some impressive numbers. There are 80,000 alumni living in the Charlotte region. Your school is the number one producer of computing degrees in the state. You're the top three producer of K-12 teachers in the state. You have the top-ranked part-time MBA program in North Carolina. And the big one is the regional impact, economic impact of UNC Charlotte is $2.1 billion. Could the Phil Dubois of 1991 or even 2005, when you arrived to be the chancellor, have envisioned those numbers?
Yeah, I think so, because it's like anything when you looked at Charlotte and the way it was beginning to develop. When I faced the question of whether in 2005 I would come back, I was coming back to build. I wasn't coming back to maintain. And I succeeded a person who was a builder, not a maintainer. And he succeeded a person and so forth, all the way back to Miss Bonnie. So it's always been about growth and development and helping the city become the best it could be. What's been most significant, Mike, about the last 15 years has been Charlotte's come to appreciate its university. And I've told the story before that Erskine Bowles, when he was first president of the university system and came to Charlotte in 2006, went to the Charlotte Rotary, and he said, "Great cities have great universities. And you won't have a great university until you, Charlotte, own the one you have." And he was talking to a group of people who'd graduated from Chapel Hill, NC State, Duke, Wake Forest, Tennessee, wherever. And I think what we've seen is the city has figured out that this is an important asset to the development of their company, their business, their family, in lots of different ways. That's been the most important aspect, I think, of the time that I've been here. The city has found us. And that means that in the future for Sharon Gaber, as she moves forward, she'll have yet additional opportunities. And trust me, she's not coming here to maintain things. She's coming here to build things.
Light rail is part of opening up an avenue into the university from Charlotte, because the light rail now goes directly from where those students have their internships on Friday and Saturday night on College Street at Bar Row, essentially, right into to the campus. And you worked very closely with Katz and with the Lynx Blue Line folks to bring that line into the campus. It could have skirted you and been on the outskirts, but it goes right into it, and it's turned out to be the final stop on the northern leg of the route. You have said that light rail was the most impactful decision you made while chancellor. How so?
Well, if you go back a little bit and think about it, light rail was beginning to occur under Mayor McCrory, and Jim Woodward was approached about bringing it up eventually to the campus. And Jim, I think, had the proper instinct, which was you don't want it going through your campus and ruining a pedestrian character that the campus had. But when I got here, the mayor, later governor, Pat McCrory, talked to me, and he says, "Can you find a way to get it onto the campus? If you can, because that'll qualify us for the federal construction funding," which was 50% of the total. And the federal people were not satisfied that it just stopped at the campus. They really insisted it come on the campus. And so we did find a route. That's why it came on, and we were able to get it done. The reason it's so impactful is, as I suggested, it gives our students the opportunity to take advantage of the city. It gives the city the chance to get to the campus without taking the worst 10 miles of highway in the city on I-85. And more importantly, all the economic development that eventually will happen along that line, like it's happened in South End, has a permanent and lasting impact on Charlotte. So I think for all those reasons, I felt that it was more important than, for example, football. I mean, I think football's been fun. It's been a labor of love over time. It'll become bigger and better eventually when we're past the virus. But it's not the kind of impact that I think light rail has had and will have.
And in fact, your decision to allow them onto the campus, to put the stop in the middle of the campus, essentially, made the light rail line north of 7th Street possible. It wouldn't have happened without that. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it was supposed to leave the campus and go all the way to 485. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a nice park and ride for people, so they could have taken their car on 485, parked it and gone all the way downtown. But right in the middle of the recession, the then Katz director, Carolyn Flowers, came to me and said, "We got to get $200 million out of this project. How do we do that?" And I said, "Well, you can stop on campus. That's fine. It was going through here anyway." Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it might have helped us, because there's nobody getting on the train before us. So we can get onto an empty car and go all the way downtown. You may remember way back when, Mike, we were talking about the Green Line coming out to Charlotte for the university, and the Red Line going to Davidson College. Katz would never have of it be called a green line. They thought people would get confused. But in any event, they did allow us to brand the last stop green. So we have the only green stop on the blue line.
let's talk about football, because I could be wrong, but my memory tells me that you were not one of the people who thought football ought to be part of the UNC Charlotte campus. But ultimately, you did ended up providing strategic leadership that ultimately brought the team, the Division I program, to the school in 2013 and later into the Conference USA Conference in 2015. What changed your mind about football?
It's true. When I got here in 2005, I didn't want to really talk about football. There were too many more important things to do, all of which you've talked about today. I couldn't go to an alumni event, though, without somebody raising the football question. I had even announced in my installation address in February of 2006, I wasn't going to talk about the F question. It was a good joke at the time, but it didn't last very long. And so the alumni started to ask, you know, why don't you take a look at it? And what really happened was my board chair, Mac Everett, sat me down one day at lunch with Judy Rose and said, you know, we gotta look at football. He said, I'm not telling you what decision to make, but we got to get it off the table. And I agreed with that. And so we appointed a citizens committee, and the rest is history. Eventually, what made the decision possible was the growth of the campus. Jim Woodward was absolutely correct. There was no way to pay for football when you're only 15,000 strong. But when I got back here, we were 20,000 strong. And by the time we got around to the football decision, we were 24,000 strong. And when you're charging a student fee for most of the budget, that's the way you've got to make it happen. So it was made financially possible by the growth of the campus. And we really had to work hard to figure out how to finance it all, particularly when I announced the football decision on the day that Bear Stearns collapsed in the recession. Not the best timing. But we made it through, and folks picked it up, and they bought seat licenses, and they bought season tickets, and so forth. And then we got lucky with Conference USA, because we were having a hard time finding a FCS conference to play in. In fact, no one wanted us, and we were an FCS independent. And then, of course, with the conference shuffling that happened with the changes in the ACC and the others, Conference USA got emptied out, and we got invited in. And it became a much more financially viable proposition with television than it was without.
So, bottom line, good decision?
Good decision.
What are you most proud of as you look back these 15?
Even better, we went to a bowl game before I left.
That's true. So what are you most proud of as you look back on these 15 years? There's so much that we've talked about and some of the things we have not talked about, but what are you most proud of?
Well, I was looking forward to commencement this year. It would have been almost my 70th commencement since I've been chancellor. Since I've been chancellor, I've had the chance to award more than 96,000 degrees and certificates. So you think about that, that's a pretty good sized city of more educated people who will enjoy better and more productive and prosperous lives because of them having graduated from UNC Charlotte. So that's number one on the list. I was a first generation college student. It changed my life for the better.
And in fact, 40% of undergraduates are first generation college students at UNC Charlotte. We only have 30 seconds left, but talk about Sharon Garber, your replacement. Who is she? What will her biggest challenge be? 30 seconds.
Sharon Garber, president of the University of Toledo for the past 5 years, 6 years as provost at Arkansas, and 9 years at Auburn as a faculty member. Her challenge is going to be managing this continuing growth and the expansion of programs at the university for sure.
We've talked many times over the time that I've done this program, over the time that you've been chancellor. I have always enjoyed these conversations, and I will miss talking to you, but I wish you the best in retirement in Georgia, someplace out there in Georgia.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.